So, hey everybody, welcome to Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Eric Mann. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. Last week we had a discussion of our late brother Fred Ho, and one of the ends of the conversation I said that we would want to have more conversations about socialism on Voices from the Frontlines. And this week, today, we're very happy to be engaged in the conversation with Stephen F. Cohen, a Soviet scholar of real import, who's going to both be talking about his article in The Nation right now called Cold War Again, Who's Responsible About the Struggle Between the United States and the Soviet Union or Russia Now Over the Ukraine and the Broader Implications. We're also going to be addressing his book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War, which I've really enjoyed, have been enjoying reading. And also, I also read his excellent biography of Buchanan. So I've read a lot of his stuff. It's the first time he and I have talked. We're really happy to have him on the show. I'll read you some of his credentials. And Stephen, are you on already? Stephen, do we have you on?
Yes, I'm here, Eric.
Okay, great. Stephen F. Cohen is a professor emeritus at New York University and Princeton University. He's the author of several books, including Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War, contributing editor to The Nation. His article, Cold War Again, Who's Responsible, speaks about the Obama administration, the media's demonizing of President Putin, and the crisis in Ukraine. A noted historian and author, Professor Cohen attempts to reshape the perception of post-Stalin Russia, the Cold War, and the present relations between Russia and the United States. Stephen, very nice to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Well, the first thing is I wanted to go back to an earlier Lost Alternative that you haven't, at least I haven't seen you write about, which is the essential debate between Lenin and Stalin that preceded the struggle between Bukharin and Stalin. I mean, there's one view that says that the atrocities of the Soviet Union, the gulags, the forced collectivization, many of the things that you describe are inherent in the communist model, and therefore communism itself is not the alternative. There's another argument that says that Lenin and Stalin were essentially the same, and therefore you can't hide behind Lenin. Now, I have a different interpretation of that, but the first question I have is, given the original import of the Russian Revolution, what did you think were some of the foundational issues that were good about that revolution? And did you think that there was an actual struggle over political line between Lenin and Stalin?
Well, to the latter question, absolutely yes. I mean, the history of the opposition movement inside the Russian Communist Party, referred to as the Bolshevik Party, from 1918 until the blood terror that Stalin enacted in the 30s, where all disputes were settled by a bullet in the head in Lubyanka prison, that whole struggle of the oppositions among themselves, left and right, with the apparatus controlled by Stalin, that was an expression of a struggle over, they thought, the people who participated in, what they thought were inherent differences or conflicts between, I don't call it Leninism, but that's okay, I tend to call it original Bolshevism, because Leninism was more than just Lenin. It was a movement. He was the head. He shaped it. He articulated it more than anyone, but other people contributed to it. And what emerged as Stalinism. Now, to this day, there's no scholarly or political agreement on what Stalinism was. There's a Trotskyist view and a Bukharinist view and a scholarly view and dozens of views inside Russia today. As for me, I describe myself by borrowing a word from some of my Russian colleagues. I'm an alternativist. I believe in alternatives, not just in Russia, but that there are always in history political alternatives. So the argument that everything that happened under Stalin, the brutal collectivization of the peasantry, the terror, the unpreparedness for Hitler's armies in June 1941, the building of a system, a barrack system, in Russia, in the Soviet Union that was called socialism. None of this was predetermined by 1917, or as some argue in academia, by Russia's preceding history. Some people believe begin with Ivan the Terrible. History and events influence things, but they don't determine them. So I'm not a determinist. I think there were alternatives. And the reason I wrote my first book about Bukharin was not because I'm a socialist. I actually have never been a socialist, but maybe of the social democratic type that existed in some European countries, but not of the Russian or Soviet type. But the reason I focused on Bukharin, he had not been studied, and I thought he represented, not as a political leader, but as a thinker and one of the several political leaders, as an actual alternative to Stalinism in the turning point year, 1928-29, when the economic policies that Lenin had enacted, the new economic policy, those market policies, were abandoned by Stalin, and collectivization and a state monopolistic system imposed on the country that lasted for decades until Gorbachev tried to dismantle it.
Well, let me ask you this, Stephen.
The answer is yes, alternatives.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, it seems to me that the first alternative that the Russian Revolution represented was a break with social democracy over World War I, and that one of its great contributions, it was the first revolution I know of that was explicitly organized against an imperialist war that itself generated 20, 30 million casualties in the European murders in the European countries. And don't you think that in itself, in that was one of the first splits, was one of the great contributions of the Russian Revolution?
Well, I don't know if it was a great contribution, but let's just begin with the historical empirical reality. You're right that the war, World War I, brought a split in what was then a fairly unified European Marxist social democratic movement into the anti-war, they still called themselves social democrats, of whom Lenin became eventually the preeminent leader. But there were many of them, and younger people for the most part, in Austria and Germany and France and England, the United States, in Russia. And that split in social democracy, some people think, gave rise to an anti-war movement that played an essential role in the 20th century. Some people think, on the other hand, it was a tragedy because it divided the opposition, for example, to the rise of fascism. But what's also interesting here is that Leninism grew out of European social democracy. I mean, Lenin was originally an adherent of Kautsky. And though Stalin stamped out the social democratic origins of Russian communism, under Gorbachev, there was an explicit attempt to return to Russian and European social democracy. It failed in Russia. But the impulse is still there in Russia today and elsewhere. So the pluses and minuses of that great split over World War I probably are something historians are going to debate for a long time, but I understand your point of view, certainly.
Well, let me just ask one other thing on that I think another contribution that Lenin made was breaking out of the entire European and Eurocentric worldview, so that when he said, workers and oppressed peoples unite, that was a pretty major, another version of the split with Kautsky and European social democracy, for the first time believing that the people in the colonies were actually historical actors. And I think that was one of the reasons why Marxism began to move so aggressively and effectively into the Third World.
Well, I don't know which came first. Some people think that the migration of ideas, as historical sociologists call them, the migration of Marxist ideas eastward. I mean, if we think about Marx, he wrote Das Kapital in the British Museum.
Right.
It was based on his understanding of the French Revolution and the evolution of British capitalism. So he created a body of thought sitting in the West and based on essentially a Western experience. Russia, before the revolution, obviously, vexed Marx, because he was constantly being asked by Russian Marxists. I think Capital was translated in Russian in 18—it was the first foreign translation of Marx's major work, and long before the revolution. So Russian Marxists began to write to Marx, what about us? Where do we fit in, right, in this picture you've given? And he gave varying answers. He was very interested in Russia. So the question you raise is interesting. Was it the migration of ideas, or was it the Russian Revolution itself that carried Marxism eastward. But we know what happens with the Russian Revolution. Increasingly, the Russian Marxists looked to Eastern rebellions, anti-colonial rebellions in India and particularly in China. And of course, the next major stop of Marxism in the East is going to be China. So, yes, remember that the Russian Revolution grows out of World War One, as does the anti-colonial movement. So it's really World War One that brings all these elements together, including the Eastern movement of Marxism, which then becomes known as communism. All that is true. All that was fateful for the 20th century. What it means today, I'm not sure. I mean, for example, my late mentor, Robert C. Tucker, who wrote the best biography of Stalin, two volumes, I think, who died at 92 a couple years ago, believed that eventually every communist system was national, that they had things in common, but the national culture in which they rooted themselves, embedded themselves politically, shaped them so differently. So his point would be that you can't really understand Cuban communism, for example, by studying Soviet or Russian communism. And that would be true of China as well. So something grew up in academic life called comparative communisms, where people were studying the way communism was understood and practiced in very different cultural societies. Now there are fewer of them, but it's still relevant.
Yeah, I think comparative communism is very, very important, and the national basis, you know, the national specificity of every revolution is a very significant factor in understanding it. So one segue, because we're going to talk a lot about the issue of Eastern Europe as a buffer between Western capitalism, imperialism, and the Soviet Union, and we're going to obviously eventually segue into the conversation today. One question I had to you is that, why was it, in terms of after the Chinese Revolution 1949, when Stalin died, was it 54?
Stalin died in March 1953.
53.
Yeah.
Mao wrote in his thing on Comrade Stalin, he said, you know, overall he gave him like a 70%. He graded him like
right,
70%
right.
Positive and 30% negative or something.
Right.
And one thing he said is he always saw me as a Tito. That he never,
right.
That he never,
a potential Tito,
a potential
yeah.
Tito,
that's
meaning
right.
That he was, that is to say, Stalin rejected any kind of independence inside the world communist movement and saw Mao more of a threat.
Yeah.
So one question I had to you is let's just take a minute on that. When the Warsaw Pact was formed after World War II, why didn't the Soviet Union reach out to China more? And why did it restrict itself to a European conception of itself?
Well, I think the answer, and here you have a dispute, what was the most important element of Stalinism? Was it Stalin himself, the way he thought, and because he had such great power, he could turn the way he thought into policy? Or was it really the nature of the system and, let's say, traditional Russian culture? I give Stalin's personal role in policy making. I emphasize it. And the evidence is how significantly it changed almost the moment he died, when other leaders came to power in Moscow. On this specific question, I think you emphasized something very important before you asked the question. Stalin was suspicious of anything he could not control. This was not only true of other states and other communisms, of a Tito or a Mao. This was true of his own comrades in the party.
Right.
Many of them wrote memoirs after the censorship ended in Russia. And those who had survived, that was a common theme, that to survive at the high levels under Stalin, you had to persuade Stalin you had no views of your own other than Stalin's. And that led to the Stalin cult, where Stalin was called the greatest everything ever. That was something that was a political institution. You had to adhere to it. Now, on a more practical level, though, the Warsaw Pact arose as a response to NATO, which was in the West at that time. NATO's everywhere now.
Right.
I mean, it's in Afghanistan. It was in Iraq. I mean, who knows where it's going to be next. But at that time, NATO was viewed reasonably as a Western military alliance directed against the Soviet Union and the countries it controlled in Eastern and Central Europe. And the Russian response was to create a counter-alliance. The Warsaw Pact right there. Then came the Korean War, remember?
Right.
And here, only now, and I don't know this subject well, but there are people who do, with the archives opened up, relations between Mao and Stalin were not smooth, to say the least. Remember, we went to war in Korea on the premise that Stalin had unleashed the North Korean and Chinese communists as though they obeyed his command.
Right.
And that we were really fighting Soviet communism in Korea. And that argument would linger on and draw us, you know, I don't know what generation you're of, but you know, one way or another, that dragged us into Vietnam also.
That's where I cut my teeth as an organizer, so I was there.
Well, so you remember that. The point is, it was untrue. The conflicts between Moscow and Beijing were growing. There was some cooperation, some military help, but the last thing Stalin wanted was a rising Mao. So he had complex, to say the least, mixed views about that. You know, this whole question goes back to whether Russia's of the East or the West. Of course, when I left Princeton and I came to NYU, I brought a Princeton course I had, but I broadened it, made it somewhat more cultural, just called it Russia since 1917. And the very first question I asked them, and they were to write essays, there were about 400 students on this, how would you answer the question, is Russia of the East or the West? And I gave them a couple little short essays on both sides of the issue. Obviously, today, we have one answer. It's both. Because that's what informs this Eurasian union and economic space that Putin wants to create that became one of the tripwires of the current Ukrainian crisis back in November. You remember that. Would Ukraine join Putin's Eurasian Union or the European Union? But this struggle of whether Russia is East or West goes on, has went on through the communist period too. One mistake people make is thinking that communists all think alike. My argument is because they believe in the same ideology, but differs on what the ideology means, and since everything is expressed ideologically, it exacerbates what might be rather dry policy disputes. Everything gets elevated into a kind of historic decision. It gets freighted with emotion because it becomes a matter of orthodoxy and heresy. And that was true about the disputes that grew between Mao and Stalin, later between Mao and Khrushchev, and led to the Sino-Soviet dispute. Now you have a new and very important phenomenon, which is the rise of a new Russian-Chinese, certainly detente, perhaps entente, perhaps strategic alliance.
Well, I definitely want to get to that. I want to take a minute to punctuate and really appreciate the historical work you did in resurrecting, which I guess is a Christian term, or reconstructing Buharin's legacy. And I just want to read a couple of things from Buharin's fate and then have you talk about it, including your own work, which is very impressive. So there's just three quotes from this chapter I want to read. First, it says, even before Stalin's ruthless measures of 1929 through 1933 had left perhaps 10 million peasants dead or enslaved in a vastly swollen gulag of forced labor camps, Buharin presciently understood their, quote, monstrously one-sided intent and their consequences. Evoking Lenin's Last Testament, a series of short articles in defense of the new economic policy written by the dying leader in 1922 and 1923, Buharin protested that socialism could not and must not be achieved through, quote, military feudal exploitation of the country's peasant majority. Quote, Stalin's policy is leading to civil war. He will have to drown the revolts in blood. The outcome, he warned, will be a police state. Then we go further, which is, of course, that's what happened. 21 defendants sat in the dock. Several of them, this is now that Stalin, of course, put Buharin on trial as an enemy of the state, as an enemy of the people. This is also from the book. 21 defendants sat in the dock. Several of them prominent old Bolsheviks, but for Stalin, it was the Inquisition and confession of Buharin that really mattered. The alternative he represented in 1928 and 29 had to be criminalized and thereby rendered forever anathema. After only the first day, the Stalinist press made clear the trial's purpose and preordained verdict. Quote, Buharin sits there with his head bowed low, a treacherous, two-faced, whimpering, evil non-entity who has been exposed as a leader of a gang of spies, terrorists, and thieves. This filthy little Bukharin. As the pseudo-judicial proceedings move toward their inexorable outcome, Stalin, through his mouthpiece prosecutor, Andrei Vyshinsky, leveled an exceptional accusation against Bukharin. The hypocrisy and perfidy of this man exceed the most perfidious and monstrous crimes known to the history of mankind. So you were talking about the nature of the ugliness of inter-party struggle. And finally, always a fragile personality, soft and artistic, according to people new in Bukharin, who was already debilitated by months of persecution and a hunger strike undertaken before his arrest. Unlike so many victims, he seems not to have been physically tortured in prison. But all the other agonies inflicted in Lubyanka over his family and closest friends, his impending trial, his historical reputation, were enough to leave his soul, quote, shattered and in torment. His grief and boundless anguish bore on episodes of hallucinatory delusions, even an occasional loss of vision, and though he seems to have always revived, his physical and spiritual strength were weakening. There are hints he may have been given drugs to calm or manipulate him. So I know a big part of your life has been going back into the Soviet archives.
Yep.
And why don't you talk about the specific monstrosity of the Stalin police state and how it impacted Bukharin. And the other aspect is his amazing, nonetheless, resistance under those conditions.
Well, you freighted a lot into this, and so let me see if I can explain it to listeners quickly and clearly.
Well, I just wanted to read a lot of your good stuff, so go ahead.
Well, I'm grateful because I haven't spoken about Bukharin in a long time. Nobody wants to talk about him anymore.
Okay.
Though he's making a comeback in Russia.
Okay.
When I was a very young man, maybe before almost all of your listeners were born, and I grew up in Kentucky, and I went off to Indiana University, and one thing led to another, and I settled on Nikolai Bukharin as a dissertation topic, as I told you before, because I thought he represented an alternative. And in 1973, I published that book, Bukharin and the Bolshevik Revolution, which still exists in an Oxford University Press paperback. But when I completed the book, in about 71 or 72, there was no, of course, access to Russian archives. Almost everyone who knew Bukharin well, with the exception of a handful of people, had been killed by Stalin. That handful of people had been put in the gulag. They were back now in Moscow and other places. Khrushchev had released them. But they weren't accessible to a person like myself. Though, in the late 70s, I made contact with Bukharin's widow and his son, and I began to learn a lot of things I didn't know. And then, under Gorbachev, and then after the end of the Soviet Union, those archives opened up, and I found a lot of things there, including what had happened to Bukharin in Lubyanka prison during the year prior to his trial. So the book you're reading from, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, begins with a kind of updated précis of my biography of Bukharin. I wanted to use that new archive material, which you cited there, about his conduct at the trial and in the prison. Now, to flash back to your point about his prescience, his foreboding, his warning that Stalin's policies of 1928-29 would lead to a police state. It wasn't complicated, but it was ideological also. Stalin had come up with what he called a new Marxist theory, that as a country successfully approaches socialism, the class struggle does not begin to wither away, as Bukharin was arguing, that is, civil peace prevails, but the class struggle actually grows more intense. And Bukharin saw immediately that this was a recipe for mass repression, that Stalin was going to justify ideologically and in Marxist terms what he intended to do. And that was what Bukharin called military feudal exploitation of the peasantry in order to industrialize backward Russia. And practically what that meant was to take the peasant's grain or its agricultural surplus without any adequate reimbursal. You could not do that through the market that existed in the Soviet 1920s under Lenin's NEP because that was a market economy. So the way to do it was to destroy the market and put in its place about 200,000 so-called collective and state farms, because then they had to deliver to the state at an agreed upon price, which was way below the production of agricultural price. And that's what happened. But before it happened, Bukharin understood the peasantry wouldn't accept it. They would rebel, and they'd have to be repressed in a violent way, and that process would create a police state and what we later called the Gulag. Bukharin was right. He was absolutely right. He wasn't the only person who saw this. Trotsky, on the other hand, captured in his own perception ideological of Stalin, didn't see it. There's not a hint of this in what Trotsky wrote during these years. He saw other things, but he didn't see this. And this, of course, was the fate of socialism. This was the fate of the Soviet Union. It was being decided in 28-29. That's why it's a mistake. And I had, growing up, many student friends who were young Trotskyists in America. A lot of them were involved with the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, if you remember that.
Of course.
They always believed that Trotsky was the arch rival of Stalin, and that's the way Stalin thought. But it just wasn't, I don't want to say it wasn't true. I want to say it wasn't solely true. It wasn't the only truth, because Stalin understood that the only programmatic alternative to what he had done in destroying the peasantry had been not just Bukharin, but all the people Bukharin spoke for and represented in the party. And therefore, when the great trials came, great, I mean monstrous, in 36, 37, 38, they were all directed toward one thing, to criminalize everything about Bukharin's life, his biography, his politics, his relationship to Lenin. He was accused of trying to kill Lenin, even though they had a father-son relationship. Everybody knew it was preposterous. But to make this the new dogma, because any memory that there had been an alternative to Stalinism in the history of Soviet socialism, Stalin regarded as a mortal threat. Now, there is evidence after Stalin dies that this was so. Because if you look at the reform movements inside the communist parties of Russia and of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe after Stalin's death in 53, almost every one of them was striving in very constrained circumstances back toward that Bukharinist alternative. That is, reintroducing the market, at least for, you know, consumer goods, modernizing the state-owned industrial sector rather than simply expanding it, introducing more freedom, economic freedom. Democracy was not yet an issue. That didn't come until Gorbachev. But nonetheless, there was no movement. Nobody rose up in dissent in those communist parties and said, we need more Stalinism for progress. Everybody became a de-Stalinizer who was a reformer. And that took them back to Bukharin, and that's why his legacy lived on in the Soviet Union so long, and why when Gorbachev finally rehabilitated him, said he wasn't guilty, in 1988, there was an incredible outburst of affection and memory and almost a cult created out of Bukharin's life. It went too far, but it was the natural pent-up reaction to decades of trying to criminalize the alternative to Stalinism. Now, when the Soviet Union ends, there's no longer a basis for finding an alternative to Stalinism in the history of Soviet socialism, because it's considered to be over, that history. I'm not so sure that's the case. Just to give you an example, either today or yesterday, I'm not sure because it's 8 hours later in Moscow, but I received by email a speech given by a short speech at the Russian Parliament by the leader of today's Russian Communist Party, Gennady Zhuganov. Now, Zhuganov is a kind of Stalinist in some regards. This has more to do with the war and Russian nationalism than it has to do with Stalin's actual policies. But even Zhuganov said today that the Russian economy is in crisis, and the only way out is what he called a new NEP, the new economic policy number two. Now, he attributes it to Lenin, but everybody in Russia knows that was the policy associated with Bukharin. So the impulse for economic reform in Russia today, which neoliberals in the West think it means monetarism and completely abolishing pensions and getting the state out of the economy, that has no traction in Russia at all, nor should it.
Stephen, I'm going to want to stop you there because I want to take a short break and make sure we get to the Ukraine. I could spend hours on this. I think the stuff you're doing is terrific. We are going to probably go to the phones in about 15 minutes, so I want to make sure that Stephen F. Cohen has a chance to talk about the Cold War again, who's responsible. This is Eric Mann, your host on KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and for many of you around the country, streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. We've been talking with Stephen F. Cohen, an expert on both Russia and the Soviet Union, and I want to make sure that we have about 15 minutes for Stephen to put forth his main thesis before we go to the phones for maybe 10 or 12 minutes at the end of the show. Excellent article in the April 1st Nation. It's called Cold War, Who's Responsible? I'll just read one paragraph and let you make your own. First, if you would, Stephen, lay out your basic hypothesis and then explain, you know, defend it. But one important thing is it says, even if the outcome is the non-military, quote, isolation of Russia, which is today's Western mantra, including parenthesis that of the Obama administration, the consequences will be dire. Moscow will not bow, but will turn politically and economically to the East as it has done before, above all to a fuller alliance with China. The United States will risk losing an essential partner in vital areas of its own national security, from Iran, Syria, and Afghanistan, to threats of a new arms race, nuclear proliferation, and more terrorism, and no small matter, prospects for resumption of Russia's democratization will be terminated for at least a generation. Those are very significant impacts, but why don't you take our listeners back to just explain in the barest sense what you understand as the facts on the ground and then give us your analysis of the situation.
Well, I think as Americans, the most important thing we pay attention to at this moment is an article that appeared on the front page of the Sunday New York Times the day before yesterday, reporting that the Obama administration had decided there was no longer any point in negotiating with Russian President Vladimir Putin, and that it was now time to adopt what was once known as the policy of containment of Russia, that is, to return to the official American policy of the Cold War. That means, if that report is true, and there have been no denials from the White House, and this was the New York Times,
right.
That means that officially, the White House now takes a view that we are in a new, or we might say renewed, Cold War with Russia. Here's the thing to note, because that's been unfolding for 20 years, that this is happening, this historic transformation of American policy, whether it's correct or incorrect, without any debate in the United States whatsoever, in the mainstream. Not a single elected official has stood up on the floor of Congress and said, hey, can we wait a minute and discuss this? Not a single editorial in the mainstream newspapers, not a single discussion on any of the mainstream radio or cable or broadcast channels, nothing. One or two voices protesting this interpretation of events, but we are, and I don't recall anything like this happening in my lifetime. Even in Iraq, where we unwisely went to war, there was a debate.
Right.
The anti-war group lost the debate, but they could have an editor, they could have an op-ed piece in the New York Times or the Washington Post and even the Wall Street Journal. They appeared on television and radio. Now it is one Cold War voice speaking, and the purpose of my Nation article was to ask the question, is the explanation of this Cold War, the official explanation, which has been accepted by virtually everybody of influence and power in the United States without dissent, that it is solely the responsibility of this Cold War, the doing, the blame for, of Putin and Russia. Is that true? And the answer in my article is that if you look at the last years of history, factually it is untrue. And then I cite things that people know about. We've been expanding NATO, the military alliance, to Russia's borders for 20 years, and eventually we crossed a red line in Ukraine. There had been plenty of red flags, warnings, episodes before. Three or four of us in this country have been writing, and to the extent that we're permitted on mainstream television or radio, saying that this was going to happen if we didn't stop. Remember, there was a kind of proxy war in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia in 2008, when we crossed, we, NATO, Washington, crossed a red line.
Stephen, I just want to hold you for one second. Folks, if you're interested in having a conversation with Stephen F. Cohen, asking him some questions, start lining up now at 818-985-5735. Stan is going to be taking your calls and holding them. Stephen's going to probably have another 7 or 8 minutes to talk, and in the last about 8 or 10 minutes, I want to make sure we get some questions. So 818-985-5735. We'll focus the conversation on the Ukraine and the present situation and not so much on the Bukharin conversation to give it some focus. Stephen, please go ahead and thank you.
Well, I would just punctuate this by saying that if there are future historians around to write this about this remarkable moment, and I say if because we're now going to have a new arms race, a nuclear arms race, so all the dangers of nuclear war that we worried about for 45 years will be back. They may be already. Historians will marvel that America entered this new Cold War with no opposition within its political class. None whatsoever. Not any. I thought for a while that the Reagan wing of the Republican Party, which thinks Reagan ended the Cold War and were angry at Clinton, Bush, and Obama for reviving the Cold War, would protest. Their spokesman would have been, presumably, Senator Rand Paul. He said a few things of dissent about a month ago, and then, probably because of his presidential ambitions, he fell silent. So I can't remember a time when there weren't some Republican and Democratic senators or congresspeople who spoke out. There's none, not one, unless I miss somebody. And historians will have to explain that. I can't explain it.
Let me ask you a very tactical question, Stephen. Okay, we'll solve it. Well, let me ask you this. Let's assume for a minute that, you know, we have always, in the movement, tried to restrict the United States' imperial aggressions and imperial aspirations. But let's deal for a minute the opposite side of this, which is the alliance with China. Because if, in fact, there's been a historical tension between the Soviet Union and China, 818-985-5735, why do you think that the two sides are moving together? And do you think it's also related to the United States declaring itself now an Asian power as well?
You're absolutely right that there are all sorts of geopolitical and cultural reasons why Russia and China should not be allies. Therefore, it's got to be something pretty powerful to drive them into this embrace. And in fact, China has been, along with Germany until this happened, Ukrainian crisis, the two most bilateral, important bilateral relations Moscow has had in the last 10, 15 years. What brings China and Russia together is first and foremost economic. China is very thirsty. It needs energy. It doesn't have energy, and it needs more energy than any country in the world. And Russia, aggregately speaking, is the world's largest producer and potentially exporter of all manner of energy. Gas, oil. By the way, Russia also may have, I'm not sure about this, the first or near first, the largest supply of fresh water, which is also something that's going to be in dire need very soon. Meanwhile, Russia needs markets to export the one thing it indisputably produces, which is military equipment. China and India buy a lot of their military equipment.
Very interesting.
Russia. But generally speaking, of course, its antipathy and to a certain extent fear of NATO, led by the United States, which both capitals, Beijing and Moscow, see coming at them. And that has pulled them together.
Well, in terms of the idea that 818-985-5735, you know, I want to go to the phones because I'm interested in people talking to you. We're going to start with Chester from Duarte. You're on with Stephen F. Cohn. What are your questions, Chester?
Wow. I picked first. I'm amazed.
Pretty good, huh?
Yeah, I have a question. It may sound a little crazy, but I just got to ask. Is it remotely possible that ourselves and the Russians are behind closed doors in cahoots with one another because the Russians are afraid of a strong united Europe on their border and we are afraid of the EU's currency becoming dominant in the marketplace?
All right, I'll ask that for Stephen F. Cohn.
Would do us good.
All right, Stephen, what, do you think there's any relevance to that?
There's an old saying, there are no crazy questions, only crazy answers. the question's fine.
Right.
I wish that was the case, because then we would not be headed for war. But I think we're two or three steps from war with Russia, and that would be a calamity. I don't even want to think about it. But all the evidence suggests that this plan, essentially, though they deny it, to take Ukraine from Russia, its 300 to, depending on where you start counting, 500 century long relationship with Russia, which, by the way, includes includes tens of millions of intermarriages. I mean, it's a conjugal relationship, not just cultural and economic and political. To take Ukraine from Russia has been a long-standing driving factor in Western policy. And the Chinese watch it. They see it as aggression. They understand what's going on. And they feel that if the West is successful in doing this, it will then turn its focus onto China. And that alone is enough for the Chinese, though they were not happy about the annexation of Crimea because they've got their own rebellious ethnic groups within China. They didn't criticize the Russians for what they did. So I wish your caller was right, because we could manage our way out of this without war. But we are sliding down the slope toward war now. Civil war in Ukraine, which will surely bring Russia across the eastern border, NATO across the Polish-Ukrainian western border, and then all bets are off.
Stan, I'm going to go to Leanne in Los Angeles. Leanne, are you on, Leanne?
I'm here.
What's your question for Stephen F. Cohen? Comment and question?
Yes. I really was interested in pursuing the issue of economic imperative, and I know you were talking about alternatives, and a lot of us are looking for alternatives in the United States, but I wondered in this situation if you can explain more whether you think the behavior of the United States right now is an extension of an economic imperative of capitalism or U.S. imperialism.
You know, I don't know the answer. I have friends who believe that we've seen all this before, that these kinds of policies toward Russia today grow out of the nature of the American capitalist system, its need for markets, its need to control resources. Certainly some leading figures in America have made statements that would suggest there's something to that. I don't remember who said it, and I don't want to misattribute it, but I think it was former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who said it wasn't fair that Russia had so many resources. And it ought to share them with the world, to which I replied, well, you have a grievance against God, not against Russia, so carry on. But there's no question that Russia's, as a potential supplier of energy to the West, without the political power that might bring, has clearly been a goal of one faction of Western policymakers. I wouldn't say all. It's just like you can't be sure even now why and how we got so deeply into Vietnam. There was an economic, or you might say imperialist motive, but there was also an ideological motive, and there was also folly. Most historians agree that you can't, for major events, settle on one factor. You need several. But, in fairness to Rian's question, today, much of the discussion is about Russia supplying, as it has for many, many decades, 30 to 40% of all of the energy consumed by Europe. And that, is that a hold Russia has over Europe? Is it why Europe is unwilling to go along with Obama's industrial sanctions against Russia? It's a major factor.
Well, one thing,
but
Stephen,
it's not the only one. It's not the only one.
No, and I think Noah, she's saying that, but I think one thing, just to elaborate, and then I want to go to another question, is that there seems to be something frightening about the fact that first the United States said that it had won the war and created a unilateral market-based world.
Won the Cold War.
It had won the Cold War, right,
right.
And it defeated so-called socialism. And now, clearly, with both China and the Soviet Union being market-based economies, it can't live with them either.
Well, the Russian answer to this is the United States got, after the end of the Soviet Union in December of 91, the United States got addicted to the idea that it was, quote, the only superpower.
Right.
And it imagined and tried to create what the Russians called a monocentric war, or unocentric world, rather, world, where there was only one great power in the world, the United States. And the Russian view is they can hope for that all they want, but in reality, what we see is that crumbling, not only with the rise of China and with Russia getting back on its feet, but even Germany, which is clearly on the rise.
That's right.
So this kind of wet dream of American strategic thinkers that America will remain the pivot. You remember Madeleine Albright had this term, we are the indispensable nation?
Right.
This became very popular in Washington. But what does it mean? Does it mean that people can't live their lives around the world unless we manage them for them? Is that what it means? We, the most provincial great power in history, who know no foreign languages, I shouldn't say that because many people know Spanish, but we don't know many European languages, who travel, have fewer travel passports than most citizens of modern countries, who know little about European history, who had a history somewhat apart from Europe, that we are going to micromanage the way people go about their politics and economics from China to Russia to Europe. It's Dr. Strangelove on steroids.
And I'll hold you there. I want to get two questions in a row from Bill, first in L.A., and then Ed. I know you will have a lot to say. If you could ask your questions clearly, and then we're going to put two together and have Stephen F. Cohen respond to both. So let's start with Bill in L.A. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I was just wondering, my question is like, should we fear a situation in which both the West and Russia lose control of the situation in Ukraine? And to wake up one morning and find ourselves in a kind of, in a Syria type of situation with civil war, failed state, and, you know, because as you can tell, that government in Ukraine, you know, no matter what, they can govern millions of their own citizens, you know?
All right, we'll hold that. So that's the first question. And then Ed in L.A., what's your question?
My question, sir, has to do with, do you believe that there's a lack in terms of imagination in the United States to get away from us just producing arms? That we are diving back into the Cold War because we are afraid to do a paradigm shift and change our economy and grow it to an economy where we have more jobs, we rebuild our country, that we have people, we put people to work.
Thank you very much. So those are the two questions. Stephen, why don't you address both of those?
Well, I actually don't know about the second question, because I think that what we see in Obama is a kind of tragedy of his presidency. I think it's possible that what happened to Lyndon Johnson after he passed the Civil Rights Bill and the new society laws and then was destroyed politically and to a certain extent his legacy by Vietnam may now happen to Obama, which I think would be a tragedy for the first African-American president of the United States to have his go down in history as the man, and I think historians may come around to my view, who contributed to put it mildly, a new Cold War that would lead to a new arms race that could gut his domestic programs. So I'm not sure if it's, you know, there, something in what the second question was suggesting is right, but I'm not sure I'd formulate it that way. The first question, though, is utterly fascinating. And for some reason, the woman who asked it sees it, or was it a man? I wasn't sure. The connection's not great. But our policymakers don't seem to see it. Ukraine is spinning out of the control of Russia and the United States. I mean, generally speaking, Russia is supposed to control eastern Ukraine. So everybody who occupies a building down there, they're Occupy Wall Street version, taking over.
Right.
Though they actually, Occupy Wall Street didn't occupy any buildings, they just sat out in the park. But these people are occupying government buildings. They're mimicking what happened in February in western Ukraine, in Kiev, which is supposed to be controlled by the United States and Europe. And in fact, I don't think Moscow, Brussels, or Washington controls much. And so what we have, you know this expression, the tail is wagging the dog?
Yep.
You got guys in black masks running around the country, you got armed militia running around the country, you got snipers shooting people, you got people posting fake anti-Semitic notices to discredit the other side. The misinformation coming out of Kiev, the government we embrace, is so overwhelming that it's swallowed by the American media, churned out the next day, forgotten but never corrected. Russia's churning its own misinformation out. So the result is that Ukraine is slipping into civil war, which neither Russia nor the West wants. But that's where it's headed as we talk. And so I think that question is exactly right. Might Ukraine take on a life completely of its own? And here is the larger folly that was in the West and in American policy. Ukraine, for the last 20 years, since the end of the Soviet Union, may have been one state, but it was never one country. It was at least two, maybe three or four, but at least two. One tied culturally, economically, politically, historically to Russia, the other to Poland, Lithuania, Eastern Europe. they yearned, the people of those two Ukraines, for different futures. And you can't argue with that. It's a reality. But no wise policy was made in the West based on that reality. Instead, in November of last year, the United States and Europe said to the elected president of Ukraine, who then had to flee to Russia, you must choose between Russia and the West. And my question is, why? Putin said, no, let's help Ukraine together. But we said, no, Ukraine must choose. That's like asking a child of divorced parents, whom the child loves equally, but the parents are warring, you must choose between your mother and your father. Why in the world would any rational policymaker do that? But by doing it, we ignited this civil war. We did it. We did it. And yet we blame only Putin. And
let me ask you this.
To Cold War without looking to ourselves.
I think, Stephen, that's excellent. I want to get the last word after your terrific job on the show. I mean, Putin has made two statements. One, as early as you said, that why is the United States obsessed with being the world superpower? And secondly, in his op-ed in the New York Times, lecturing a country and saying the absurdity of American exceptionalism, you just can't seem to live with the rest of the world. So going back to the intersection of Leanne's question about the economic imperative and the other question of U.S. cultural manifest destiny and a whole country based on this is a very, very frightening set of dynamics. And I want to thank you, Stephen, for being one of the voices that is using your expertise to stand up for world peace. I have to say it, you know, not that you're in charge of world peace, this is your new job, but I really appreciate the rationality and the kind of brilliance of your observation. Hope we can have you on the show again.
Thank you, Eric, very much. All best.
Take good care. Well, everybody, that was kind of mind-blowing for me. I want to thank our friends and for Morris and Michael and others on the line. I'm sorry we didn't get to you. We'll try to get to you early next week. So you've been listening to Voices from the Front Lines. That was Stephen F. Cohen. We went from the Russian Revolution, Bukharin, and the fact that I think we have a real obligation to stand up to the Obama administration on its provocation of a world war. We're going to be back next week on Voices from the Front Lines. And we'll see you next week. Take good care, everybody. All power to the people.